The New Hampshire campaign trail is a free-for-all these days. Candidates attacking each other, that we expect. Even the candidates expect that.
They're mad at me today, they're mad at me yesterday, mad at me tomorrow, they're going to be mad at me for a long time, yes.
But some candidates are actually celebrating getting attacked.
It's good to be attacked. It means I'm in a game.
We're seeing protesters confronting candidates.
Shouted toward Trump, quote, enjoy your burger, racist.
And candidates taking on those protesters.
I understand that you're very confused.
When they're not taking on the media.
Rand Paul literally gave the media the finger during...
And then there's the feuds no one expected.
Martin O'Malley. I will crush Martin O'Malley.
In other words, it's time to get over that confusion, put down that burger, lower that finger, and get in the game. Because in New Hampshire, with just weeks to go before February 9th, it's crush or be crushed. From New Hampshire Public Radio, it's Primarily Politics. I'm Brady Carlson. Coming up, forget the polls, except for the ones showing how great we're doing. And meet the man and the rubber rat that forever separated frontrunners from fringe on the debate stage. But first, the competition over the first ballots in the nation. Dixville Notch in northern New Hampshire is well known for its midnight voting. And, fun fact, it's also where Mitt Romney's mom once sat atop a 700-pound elephant named Popsicle in support of her husband George Romney's presidential bid. Long story. But Dixville Notch is only one town among several that casts those early votes, and they can't all be first. As they say in the movie Highlander, there can be only one. Ian Aldrich is senior editor at Yankee Magazine, and he wrote about the small-town midnight voting rivalry for the January-February issue of the magazine. And he's here now with more. Great to have you, Ian.
Well, thanks.
So when we ask, where does the first-in-the-nation presidential primary start, what's the answer?
Well, I wish I knew where it actually started. You know, it's sort of a bone of contention. You know, even after my story was published, I got a nice letter from a man who lived in Peterborough, right near Dublin, where we work. And he had said that years ago, he had talked to a man from Sharon, which is next door to Peterborough, who claimed that they had some early voting, and they may have been the first town to sort of institute this early voting. So I don't really know the answer to that. You know, and I think a lot of these towns that started this early voting, it was born out of necessity. I mean, you take the town like Hart's Location up in the White Mountains. They started in 1948 predominantly because most of the residents were railroad workers. That's when they could vote, was at midnight, you know. And so they instituted this voting time, and it went until 1964 until the press discovered it. And it just became too much for them. I mean, this is a town of like 30 residents, and as the story goes, an old-timer complained that he couldn't go to the outhouse without being followed by a reporter. So they were like, that's enough. So
they said, thanks, but no thanks. Yeah. Meanwhile, Dixville Notch had a very different response thinking about the media attention. In fact, the owner of the Balsams, Neil Tillotson, talking with a reporter from the Associated Press, gave birth to the legend that we all think of when we look at that midnight voting tradition.
Yeah, he embraced it. You know, he had sort of stumbled into becoming a hotel owner. He had bought this grand resort sort of out of, as he later described it, out of a fit of sentimentality because his grandmother, who was a full-blooded Abenaki Indian, had squatted on the land there. He bought the hotel, which included the property where his grandmother had lived. And I don't think he was that excited about being a hotel owner. He kind of tolerated it. He had made his fortune inventing the latex balloon. We have him to thank for that. This AP reporter came to him and said, this is sort of pandemonium. We want to settle on one place. You know, we go to these towns. They don't have enough telephones. We can't get the news out. You have the perfect spot for it. You know, if you do it, we'll come there. We'll make it an event. And he did, and he embraced it. And over the next, you know, five decades, it became the place.
And, of course, that tradition is continuing because now Ohio Governor John Kasich is on his way to Dixville Notch.
Yeah.
That just announced. Of course, though, not the only game in town when it comes to the midnight voting. You talked about Hart's Location, and there's also Millsfield, New Hampshire, another town that started the midnight voting decades ago, gave it up, and now is looking to get back in the game.
Yeah, it seems they did it once in 1952. The only documentation of this was a story in Time magazine right after the 1952 primary where they made mention of these voters in Millsfield going to this woman's house and under kerosene lamps voting. There's no other account. There's no, you know, there's no historical society there. And so Wayne Urso, who is a transplant and a selectman, wanted to reprise this in part because he wants to bring a little of that Dixville spotlight to Millsfield. I mean, he makes no bones about that. But also he wants to sort of, whether it's one time or whether they do it successive times, recreate what was done and leave sort of markers for future Millsfield residents to sort of say, hey, look at this tradition. They'll have documentation of something being done. They want to leave a better record.
We know about Dixville being a very media-friendly tradition. And in some of the other small towns, it's been a very different voting experience.
It has. And, you know, you get these small towns, and these aren't just small towns the way we sort of think of these towns of sort of 800 residents. They're towns of like 30 people, 20 people. In Dixville Notch, it's basically the Balsams and their employees. In Millsfield, several years ago, they were voting on a washing machine of someone's in someone's house, Etta. And people would file in, and Etta would make cookies, and people would vote on the washing machine, and then a state inspector came one day and showed up and came in and said that the parking lot was too small, couldn't accommodate all the voters. The building wasn't handicap accessible. And they were like, okay, we'll try and make some accommodations. And then he went in and he said, well, where do you vote? And Etta pointed to her washing machine. He went, you can't vote there. Well, she said, well, what about the bathroom? We could vote in the bathroom. So he goes into the bathroom. He takes measurements. It's not handicap accessible. Well, the only resident in Millsfield who was handicapped was Etta herself. And so she was fuming mad. And she said, you don't think I can go to my own bathroom?
Touché.
Touché. But they eventually moved it to the local B&B. And there they voted until they decided they wanted to do this midnight voting. And there's a big restaurant there called Log Haven. It's sort of this big, spacious lodge. And it's perfect for this kind of thing.
Now, the state law about midnight voting says it's okay so long as the polls stay open until everybody in town has voted. And have there ever been any cases in some of these small towns where somebody overslept or didn't get the memo and, you know, they have to stay open for hours and hours waiting for one person to show up and vote?
Well, in Hart's location, they decided to reprise midnight voting in 1996. The owners of the Notchland Inn just thought it would be a great kind of PR thing. They would host Dennis Kucinich, and they had to give him his vegan Thanksgiving dinner, you know, and sort of you get all these. And that first year, and that's the key, you've got to have everybody there. And that first year, someone didn't show up, and so they had to send somebody out. And I think he just overslept. He'd forgotten about it. You know, it was a new thing. He wasn't around in 1964. And so they taxied him back to the Notchland where they voted, and it was taken care of. So it was, I guess it was the closest of the close calls.
Is there something still valuable? Is it something more than a nice show to put on for the national press as they visit New Hampshire once every 4 years?
I think it is. I mean, I think the fact that, like we just talked about, sort of everybody has to be there. I talked to Steve Barba, who oversaw these voting sessions, and he said, you know, when you had all these reporters there and it would get really quiet and everybody would be in their voting booth. And at that moment, you know, it's sort of, you really sort of felt the heartbeat of democracy. And that's what made it so special. Democracy in a very small scale that works and works well.
Ian Aldrich of Yankee Magazine. Thanks so much. This is great.
Oh, this is great. Thank you.
Ian Aldrich of Yankee Magazine. You'll find a link to his piece, Race to the Ballot Box in New Hampshire, at our website, nhpr.org. You heard Ian mention that two-time Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich once had a vegan Thanksgiving in Hart's location, which is one of the midnight voting towns. Well, I talked with Ed Butler, who's the owner of the Notchland Inn in Hart's location. He said Kucinich and his wife Elizabeth were very happy with the accommodations and the tofurkey-based dinner they had that Thanksgiving. And he said Kucinich did get at least one vote that year in Hart's location's midnight voting. And Butler had a word for any prospective presidential candidates for 4 years from now. The Notchland Inn is still available for bookings for Thanksgiving 2019. There are just a handful of requirements to get on New Hampshire's primary ballot, a little paperwork, and a filing fee of $1,000. Because of that, the first in the nation ballot is a long one. In addition to the big names, there are scores of unknown candidates who probably aren't going to pick up any delegates in our primary, but may leave us with a good story or two. Joining me now with a look back at some of the lesser-known candidates is Felice Bellman, politics editor at the Boston Globe. Hi there.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
When you talk with New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner about the primary, sometimes you feel like the thing he's proudest of is that these lesser-known people can come into his office and file for the primary just the same as if it was Barack Obama or George W. Bush or one of the big-name candidates.
You're right. It's a point of pride that he treats them all with utter respect. They all get some of his time, the Secretary of State. You know, I've been thinking about how the view of the New Hampshire primary when you're in New Hampshire is so different from what the rest of the world sees. I mean, they get reports about the horse race and the advertising and the insults back and forth. But if you live in New Hampshire, you might see what's essentially performance art on the street at any given time from a guy who claims he's running for president.
Now, you put together a list of some of the most memorable lesser-known candidates over the years, and that list had to start with Ned Kahl and what he did in the 1972 primary.
There was a debate between Ed Muskie, George McGovern, and other big-name candidates, but they also let this guy named Ned Kahl onto the stage. And he sort of stole the show. He had this prop that wasn't evident from the beginning, but he really cared about urban decay and urban renewal and helping cities and poverty. He had a large rubber rat with him, and he sort of hoisted it over his head and waved it, and he said, "This is the real problem." And all the decorum in the debate was sort of gone after that. It's crazy.
Another name on your list of lesser-known candidates is one that I'd heard of, but not in politics, Tom Laughlin, because he was a movie actor.
That's right. Tom Laughlin was a movie actor of movies that aren't so well-known these days, but once were. He played a cowboy kind of candidate called Billy Jack, but he was also an ex-Green Beret Vietnam veteran. And he came in 1992, and nobody was paying much attention to him, except for Vietnam vets, who felt like, at least at that point in time, 1992, so it's a long time ago already, nobody was paying attention to them. And Billy Jack, Tom Laughlin, actually paid attention to them, and he had a campaign in New Hampshire that was all about veterans. Of course, he wasn't going to win the New Hampshire primary or the nomination, but his campaign served as sort of a megaphone for the needs of people who otherwise weren't being listened to. And in that way, a fringe candidate really made a difference in New Hampshire beyond just being sort of part of the circus. It's interesting.
And that is kind of an interesting point, because you could easily chalk it up to, oh, someone who's just looking for attention or doesn't have a hobby and could use one. But, you know, some of these candidates really do have issues they're trying to bring up, whether or not they're considered the top drawer issues or not.
I think that's right. There's a guy on the ballot this year, Steve Comley, who is a dogged anti-Seabrook opponent, see the Seabrook nuclear plant. This is a campaign he's been waging for, I don't know, 25 years. And, you know, in the 70s and 80s, it was popular. Today, there's not that many anti-Seabrook protesters left, but he's using the New Hampshire primary as a way to focus in on what he considers unsafe conditions at Seabrook. So it's interesting. It's for $1,000, you get your name on the ballot, and perhaps it brings heightened attention, or maybe nobody's paying attention. Hard to say at this point.
A lot of times you'll see candidates who will run over and over and over, and the one that seems to get the most mainstream attention is the one with perhaps the most unusual name, Vermin Supreme.
Vermin Supreme. He's sort of a performance artist slash politician. He runs over and over again. He runs with a boot on his head, sometimes he's carrying a gigantic toothbrush, and he has promised ponies for all in the Vermin Supreme administration. The craziest thing about him is there is an event coming up, a sort of forum or debate for all these lesser-known candidates. The organizers never use the word fringe candidates, but that's sort of who they're talking about, is these guys. And Vermin Supreme has been disinvited because his behavior got a bit out of hand the last time around.
How essential are these kinds of candidates to the character of the New Hampshire primary? I mean, you said that we have a different experience seeing the primary up close than you might get from watching it on TV or reading about it in a newspaper.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, it's cold in New Hampshire, the winters are long and dark, and this sort of adds a bit of circus, a bit of theater to the whole thing. Also, you know, I've heard Bill Gardner talk about this in less bemused tones, and what he'll say is, you know, this country promises that anybody who wants to can run for president. New Hampshire's actually a place where that can happen. I mean, I'm living now in Massachusetts, and on the Democratic ballot, there's four candidates. There's Hillary Clinton, there's Bernie Sanders, there's Martin O'Malley, and one of these lesser-known candidates has made it onto the ballot. So it's a very different experience, for better or for worse, I would guess.
Well, Felice, I look forward to whatever they bring to us here in the primary.
Me too. Thanks so much.
That's Felice Bellman of the Boston Globe. As she mentioned, there's going to be a forum for these lesser-known candidates next week at St. Anselm College. And one hopeful who will not be there is Vermin Supreme. He got in some hot water at the 2011 event for dumping glitter on another candidate. The glitter bombing is one of the many events that have turned him into the best-known lesser-known candidate. That is a contradiction in terms, but that might be apropos, given that we're talking about a guy who can trace the history of humor in politics from the Founding Fathers in the 18th century to the Yippies in the 1960s, all while wearing a boot on his head and vowing to power the country using zombies. So for those lesser-known candidates hoping to become better-known in New Hampshire, some pro tips from Vermin Supreme.
I think a tried-and-true method in my own campaign has been to confront other candidates, those who consider legitimate. I think it involves hijacking their press. For example, when I recently filed to run in New Hampshire, I timed it so that I would be 15 minutes before Ben Carson's arrival, and I was able to hijack completely his press, his hundreds of supporters, and I essentially filibustered, making him wait for me to finish. I mean, over the years, of course, a number of political operatives have become fans, or if not fans, at least know what I do, and that's paid off in spades. In 2012, for example, when we forced a Rick Santorum event outside, the fire marshal shut him down for having too many people, they were completely unprepared for that switch. But I had a bullhorn, and I was willing to let Rick Santorum use my bullhorn. He was introduced with my bullhorn. When it was given to him, he looked at it, saw the Vermin Supreme sticker, and quietly put it down. Nobody likes to see me coming towards their candidate, but they take solace in the fact that I am going to every candidate doing the same thing. I mean, America has a need for more humorous politics. Let's say up in Canada, they have the Rhinoceros Party. In England, it's the Monster Raving Loony Party. I believe that there is certainly room for expansion in humor in the political process here in America. I believe that I present an opportunity to give those who are disaffected, disillusioned, or disgusted with the process an opportunity to be able to concretely express their disgust by putting my name forward as a candidate.
That's pony enthusiast, internet meme, and multiple-time presidential candidate Vermin Supreme. And as there is literally no way I can follow up that conversation, that's all for now. We'll be with you each week leading up to the New Hampshire primary. You can check out our past episodes on iTunes and Audioboom, or learn more about the show at nhpr.org. You can send me a tweet with your questions and comments. I'm at Brady Carlson, all one word. I'd love to hear what you think. We had help this week from Sarah Ashworth, Josh Rogers, Dan Barrick, Peter Biello, Emily Corwin, Sam Evans-Brown, Taylor Quimby, and Rebecca Lavoy. Thanks to each of them, and thanks to you for listening. We'll see you next week on Primarily Politics from New Hampshire Public Radio.